Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. You should, of course, always be careful to get everything exactly right. It's old Windsor. Let me begin with some quotations. Here's one from Mr. Justice Learned Hand, the great, scholarly, highly praised Learned Hand, referring to the provisions of the Constitution and the role of the judge. The words he, the judge, must construe are empty vessels into which he can put nearly anything he will. In short, the Constitution is really of no great consequence. It's whatever the judge says it is. Here's another quotation, more modern one, Mr. Justice Blackmun in the Becky case. The great generalities, he's quoting Cardozo actually here, the great generalities of the Constitution have a content and significance that vary from age to age. In other words, it's not really what Madison and Co. wrote, it's whatever is thought to be the Constitution from age to age. And then Blackmun went on to say, these precepts of breadth and flexibility and ever-present modernity are basic to our constitutional law. Here's Woodrow Wilson when he was a professor of political science before he went into politics. The Constitution cannot be regarded as a mere legal document to be read as a will or contract would be. It must, of the necessity of the case, be a vehicle of life. In other words, it changes with the circumstances of life. He added there these words about government. Government is not a machine, but a living thing. It falls not under the theory of the universe, but under the theory of organic life. It is accountable to Darwin, not to Newton. It is shaped to its functions by the sheer pressure of life. No living thing can have its organs offset against each other as checks and live. In other words, checks, balances, well, they may or may not mean anything. Here's one by Lawrence Tribe, Professor Lawrence Tribe of Harvard Law School. The Constitution is an intentionally incomplete, intentionally, notice that, he no doubt had a word with Madison and Co., intentionally incomplete, often deliberately indeterminate structure for the participatory evolution of political ideas and governmental practices. And here's Learned Hand again. Learned Hand said, the general admonitions of the Constitution, like due process, equal protection of the law, etc., are left wholly undefined. Indeed, these fundamental concepts, these fundamental canons are not jural concepts at all, in the ordinary sense, and in application, they turn out to be no more than admonitions of moderation. So when a judge has to construe the Constitution according to Learned Hand, the only real constraint upon him is to practice moderation. Here's another one. This is Woodrow Wilson again. It is therefore peculiarly true of constitutional government that its atmosphere is opinion, the air from which it takes its breath and vigor. The underlying understandings of a constitutional system are modified from age to age by changes of life and circumstance and corresponding alterations of opinion. It does not remain fixed in any unchanging form, but grows with the growth and is altered with the change of the nation's needs and purposes. clearly a living document. Incidentally, if I may just take up one point in Learned Hand's second statement, that those general admonitions are not really, as he describes them, jural concepts, and they're not defined and so on. Actually, that isn't historically true, at least in the case of one of them, due process. Right back, way back, hundreds of years ago, in 1354, in the reign of Edward III, about the time of the Battle of Crecy, Parliament, the English Parliament, passed an act which included the following words, that no man, of what estate or condition he be, shall be put out of land or tenement, nor taken, nor imprisoned, nor disherited, nor put to death, without being brought in answer to due process of law. For all I know, it may be that the words due process of law were used even before 1354, but certainly way back to 1354, the English Parliament used that language. And the lawyers, Fortescue, Bracton, and then later, of course, Coke and all the others, paid attention to the definition, the meaning of due process of law. Of course, it's true that it was a concept which required elaboration and definition as time went on, and it had to be considered whether it applied to things that were not thought of in 1354. But it isn't true that there are concepts which are complete, which were completely indeterminate when Learned Hand referred to it in this particular case. Of course, in the 17th century, the question arose whether taxation, or at least one of the taxes, ship money, was putting a man out of land or tenement without due process of law. King Charles I said it wasn't. John Hampton said it was. Some of the judges said the king was right. Some of the judges said that John Hampton was right. In the end, it had to be settled by force of arms. But it was then settled by force of arms. And then, of course, the scope and meaning of due process of law was expanded. But that was still well over 100 years before 1787. And it was really, in English jurisprudence, a pretty well understood concept. But Learned Hand, the great scholar, the great man of style, great judge, somehow hadn't learned that at law school. Now, here we have then these statements, which all suggest that the Constitution is something almost completely fluid, a living document which a judge is entitled to, in fact, is in duty bound to construe as he thinks fit. But let me give you another quote. Oh, sorry, there's another quotation in the same vein, a famous, very famous one, by Mr. Justice Holmes, which applies. There are two which apply, one to all law and one to the Constitution only. In his famous, or I would prefer to call his infamous, dissenting judgment in Lochner versus New York, you will remember, Mr. Justice Holmes said that the Constitution is not made for any particular economic doctrine. It is made for people of very diverse views about economic doctrines, which, if it meant anything, was that the Constitution could be conformable with communism, fascism, socialism, liberalism, anything you like. A fundamental error, if ever there was one, because in fact most of those systems simply couldn't tolerate the liberties of the Constitution, the checks and balances, the separation of powers. It would be impossible to run a socialist, a truly socialist or communist system on that basis. But that's what the great, learned, and very highly praised Mr. Justice Holmes said. And the other very famous one, which applied to law generally, was, which has been quoted and re-quoted and quoted over and over again, no doubt everybody's familiar with it, what the courts say the law is, and nothing more pretentious is what I mean by the law. Remember that famous one, dictum of Holmes. And if that means anything, it means that rules, ultimate constitutional constraints, don't really mean much, if anything. What the courts say the law is, that's the law, and nothing more pretentious. And like most mischievous sophistries, it at first sight seems to have some truth, because everybody knows that there is a sense in which what the courts say is the law, of course. What the Supreme Court says the Constitution is, that is the Constitution. That's a sense. But that's a sophomore sense, or a freshman sense. What really matters, of course, is why the Supreme Court says that so-and-so is the law. What is it that induces it to say that that is the law? And then when one looks at that, one may find that antecedent to the decision of the court, there is something which really makes the law and penetrates the minds of the judges. Now let me give you another quotation. This is from Chief Justice Marshall. As usual, he hits the nail, in my opinion, right on the head, as he always did. And here it is, in McCulloch and Maryland. Let the end be legitimate, let it be within the scope of the Constitution, and all means which are appropriate, which are plainly adapted to that end, which are not prohibited but consist with the letter and spirit of the Constitution, are constitutional. As a matter of fact, that was quoted by Blackmun in the Vackey case in favor of flexibility. But of course you will see that the flexibility endorsed by Chief Justice Marshall was a flexibility severely constrained. Let me repeat it. Let the end be legitimate, that's number one. Let it be within the scope of the Constitution, that's number two. And all means are which are appropriate, which are plainly adapted to that end, that's number three. Which are not prohibited, but consist with the letter and spirit of the Constitution, are constitutional. Yes, we shall see that there is flexibility, but it's flexibility which is duly and properly constrained by some fundamental limits. Well, here we have these conflicting views, and we know that in the last 30 or 40 years, the view that the Constitution is a living document, that flexibility is the be-all and end-all of it, has on the whole been in the ascendant. And of course, we all know that it has had great consequences for the American people and indeed for the Constitution itself. Well, we have darkness, we have light. You may perhaps remember the famous couplet of John Squire, which he wrote at the time when Einstein's relativity theory hit the world some 60, 70 years ago, and very few people understood it. And you remember he said, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. The Lord said, let Newton be, and all was light. It didn't last. The devil shouted, ho, let Einstein be, and restore the status quo." Well, so one might say, freedom and freedom's laws lay hid in night. The Lord said, let Locke, let Hume, let Smith, let Madison, let Jefferson, let Marshall be, and all was light. It didn't last. The devil shouted, ho, let Douglas, let Warren, let Holmes, let Brandeis be, and restored the status quo. Well, let's now consider what possible flexibility there truly is in the construction of the Constitution. For there is some. And it's in the elucidation of the limits of flexibility that we, I believe, can come to a conclusion about the true nature of the Constitution. Let's then consider some of the possibilities. One which is commonly asserted is that, after all, a constitution in a democracy, or if it's not a democracy, in a state where power is responsible to the people and properly responsible to the people, cannot survive if the people don't want it. And that's a fundamental rule or law of a democracy or of a state, a system in which, in the end, power has to be responsible to the people. If, therefore, the people's views about the Constitution change and change fundamentally, there is no way of preserving the Constitution as it was. It must either change or it must break. And that is a fundamental reason why it must be a living document. It must change in accordance with the views, the deep-seated, confirmed views of the majority of the people. It's an attractive position, but false. It is true, of course, it's a fact of life, that no constitution can stand if, in fact, the people are determined that it shall not. If their ideology is fundamentally changed, they will discard it, and nothing can preserve it. That is entirely true. But that doesn't mean that the guardians of the constitution have to be aiders and abettors of its destruction. They may have to go down in flames with the Constitution. It's a fact of life that it cannot be preserved. But they have a function, which is that of the guardians of the Constitution. And it may even be that determined resistance by them to its popular destruction may perhaps, with luck, deter the people from destroying it. But in the end, if the people want to destroy it, they'll destroy it. But it's one thing for the people to determine to destroy it. It's another thing for the guardians of the Constitution to aid and abet them. After all, it's an old story. It's very old indeed. Weak-kneed guardians always think they have to aid and abet. They have to bend with the storm and so on. Politicians may have a right to bend with the storm. But the guardians of the truth, the guardians of the Constitution, have no such right. We all know the story of the golden calf. We all know what happened when the children of Israel got restive because Moses was away up in the mountain. And so they said to Aaron, give us a god that we can worship, etc. And what did he say? Yes, okay, give me your jewelry, give me your daughter's jewelry, your daughter-in-law's jewelry, etc. And he made the golden calf. When Moses came down and demanded an explanation, what could he say? What could Aaron say? All he could say was, the people wanted it. As the guardian that Moses had left, of course, it was a sin against the light. It was a breach of his duty. And this is a common thing, of course, but nevertheless one that every judge who is appointed as a guardian of the Constitution should have written in large letters before him that whatever he does, he doesn't have to impute flexibility into the Constitution just because the people don't like it or will destroy it. Then, if they will, they will. After all, if you think a moment, there are dozens of countries that have had written constitutions, many of them copies of the American Constitution, which haven't lasted 5 minutes. Have lasted 5 minutes because the minds and hearts of the peoples concerned were not with the Constitution. Well, that was too bad. That's how it goes. But fortunately for the American people, the minds and hearts of the American people were with it for a very long time. There is a sense, and indeed an important sense, I would say, that in which the American people in the days of the Depression in the 1930s did decide to tear down part of the Constitution. And the judges, the guardians of the Constitution, manfully resisted, until the so-called switch in time to save nine. And then supinely, they aided and abetted, and they've been aiding and abetting the destruction, at least of part of the Constitution, since then. So, if one is to elucidate the limits of flexibility, what the people want in the sense that they wish to flout the Constitution is no guide at all, not for the judges, not for the guardians of the Constitution. Well, then next, there is the argument that the Constitution is 200 years old. It's an 18th century document. It's couched in 18th century language, and it embodies 18th century doctrines. This is the 20th century. It can't be right simply to live in the past, or, as it is said sometimes, to be tied to the dead hand of the past. That too is false. The fact of the matter is that the major, the basic constructions of the Constitution are timeless. They don't deal with the particular problems of the people of the 13 colonies or states in 1787. They deal with timeless problems, problems that the human race have had to face over and over again. Some of them knew their Cicero and their Livy. I think even some of them knew their Herodotus and their Thucydides. And they knew about these problems in Cicero. They knew how the Roman Republic dealt with some of these problems. These matters of liberty and property and the limitation of power, etc., these are timeless. The Constitution in that sense was written sub specie aeternitatis. Therefore, it's not true that they simply deal with the temporal positions, temporal problems of the 18th century. That's no argument. However, the concepts which are put forward in the Constitution, it is true, very largely, are not closely defined. And it is also true that they are capable of growing and changing, in certain respects, growing and changing interpretation as the nature of society changes. So that to that extent, some flexibility is proper, indeed desirable. Well, let's consider then what the limits of such flexibility may be. Now let's go step by step, starting with something that's not constitutional, and consider how a judge, doing his work properly, would approach the problems before him. Let's start with the construction of statutes, wills, contracts, legal documents. Now there, a judge who is doing what he should do must be a strict constructionist. There are rules, pretty strict rules, about how to construe statutes, wills, contracts, documents, and so on. Not absolutely strict, because, of course, the problems arise in contracts and in statutes, too, which were unforeseen when those documents were drafted. And then the judge has to consider what they mean in a new context, and he is entitled to say, the statute says ABC, it doesn't say anything about XYZ. However, I believe that if the draftsmen of the statute had known of the future arrival of conditions XYZ, they would have said so and so. There he is acting in a proper judicial manner, because he is saying, I seek the law, I try to find the law, I am not trying to make it, I try to find the law in the womb of the statute, and I draw that law out from the womb of the statute, which, when the statute was drafted, was not yet born. If he's a little clumsy, he'll do it by Caesarean section. But if he's not, he'll do it by natural delivery. What he's not entitled to do is to say, XYZ has supervened, which wasn't foreseen by the draftsmen of the statute, and so to hell with the statute. I'll decide what ought to be done in the light of what I think to be just in the XYZ situation. He's not entitled to Senate. Now, most judges, most lawyers apprehend that this is the true position, but not all. There have been judges who have decided that it's up to them to decide what is just, period. Nothing is more dangerous than a judge who simply seeks justice. It's true that if he's skilled, if he's a learned judge, if he really knows the law, then when he seeks justice just like that, he may not do too much harm. But of course, a judge who really knows his duty, who really knows what he's supposed to do, seeks justice according to law. Not just justice, but justice according to law. That's why we don't ask King Solomon to adjudicate. He made a very inspired judgment once. But somebody like King Solomon would probably make an awful mess of the laws that come out of Congress. Or you might even ask the Pope or the Archbishop of Canterbury to sit on the Supreme Court or the House of Lords, etc. But we don't. Oh, gosh, I've got a lot to say yet. Oh, I haven't even got there. Oh, I've got to rush on now. Okay, now let's move to the common law. With the common law, one has more inchoate problems, inchoate concepts. Now there, the proper posture of the judge is that he, again, seeks the solution to the problems that come before him, which are new, in the womb of the common law. And there, the scope for flexibility is greater, precisely because the judgments which bind him are in fact never, or hardly ever, as precisely stated as, say, a statute or a contract or will may be, where the draftsmen try to take account of all kinds of eventualities. One can see this, the way in which a judge has to amend the precedents of the common law, if one looks, say, at the development of a subject like the law of negligence or the law of contract. If one takes, for example, the age-old salutary principle of caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, which was an excellent, and indeed remains fundamentally an excellent principle for a good and free society in a good system of law. It clearly worked pretty easily and simply if you were a buyer of a horse and all you had to do was to look at his teeth and make sure that you weren't taken in. But, as you may remember, in the famous case of McPherson versus Buick, when it came to purchasing a car, the thing was different. And, of course, nowadays, when you buy all kinds of marvelously sophisticated technical goods, the consumer has no way of looking into their teeth to see whether they are what they're supposed to be, etc. And so, quite properly, the judges have developed the law of contract in such a way as to move, to some extent, the principle from caveat emptor to caveat venditor. Let the seller beware. But a judge who does that properly, with a true understanding of the nature of the processes of law, should always do it, must always do it, on the footing that all he is doing is in fact applying what the earlier judges would have applied had they lived into the modern times when the new situations arose. But of course, there is an enormous temptation to imperial judges, judges who want to make a great mark for themselves and so on, to go much further. If you take, for example, the terrible modern development of almost 100% product liability, which has been fastened upon industry, notably by the former well-known Chief Justice of California, Judge Traynor. It's a ludicrous and indeed terribly disastrous development, which was done not by considering what, in fact, the principles of the common law would have led one to, but by considering, in Traynor's case, what he thought was just. And what he thought was just, without reference really to the nature of the law, was to say, well, after all, the producers can insure, can't they? John Smith, who buys their products, he doesn't insure. So let the producer have almost 100% product liability, and they can insure against it, so that's okay. It wasn't his business to decide that. That was a matter of legislation, if in fact it ever had to be decided. But nevertheless, that's how he decided. There is then a great temptation, and sometimes very fine judges will overstep the mark, but the principle is clear. Well, now we come to the Constitution. In the case, can you give me a few more minutes, please? In the case of the Constitution, let's see what kind of flexibility is proper. Let's suppose that those military advisors that President Reagan has sent to El Salvador brought home, and let's suppose they are truly civilians, maybe they're professors of military science or something at Harvard, Yale or somewhere, and let's suppose that then the president quarters them in citizens' homes without the consent of the citizens. Now the Third Amendment says that no soldiers may be quartered in the houses of the people without their consent in peacetime. What would a court do in looking at that? I believe that the court would properly say the founding fathers didn't know about military advisors of this kind. They just said soldiers. But we aver that, in fact, it is a proper development of that constitutional limit on the government's power to say these military advisors are on all fours. Therefore, they can't be quartered. And the Third Amendment would stop that. Of course, they wouldn't really need the Third Amendment. They could use the Fifth Amendment, because it would be a deprivation of property also, possibly liberty. But they could do it. But now let's suppose that when revenue agents go down into the Appalachians to look for moonshiners, suppose that the government quartered those revenue agents in the people's homes in peacetime. Would it be proper for that to be stopped by a court on the basis of the Third Amendment? I apprehend that a great many judges would say, yes, of course, we'll show these so-and-sos, and we'll protect the people by using the Third Amendment. It would be improper. The words are clear. They can be stretched and properly stretched within their true penumbra, but not further. If the court wished to prevent the government from quartering the revenuers on people's homes, they would have to use something else, the Fifth Amendment. The point is that a judge would have a certain proper flexibility, but always seeking not to make the law, but always to find it, stretching it here, pulling it a bit there, but always with the purpose of trying to find it. Let's take another case. Suppose, or let's take the way in which the simple words, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, have been construed. I would say there isn't any other civilized country in the world, or English-speaking country in the world, where the judges could conceivably have deduced from those simple words what the Supreme Courts of the United States have deduced. It's absolutely obvious what the Founding Fathers were talking about. They knew what the establishment of religion was. They saw it in England. The Church of England was an established church, and that's what they didn't want. That should mean that on official occasions the American people shouldn't mention the word God, that the Ten Commandments shouldn't be put up on the walls of public schools in Kentucky, where recently they've been torn down, that it should mean that public money should not be used to pay for parochial schools, just couldn't conceivably have been deduced from that. Nevertheless, it's been deduced from it, as we all know. It's so unbelievable to people outside the United States, as you can see from lots of circumstances. The Church of England is still an established church in England, actually. It's almost arguable it isn't anymore, but still, perhaps is. But in Wales, the Church of England was disestablished 70 years ago. You walk across the border from Wales to England or England to Wales, you won't notice any difference. The only difference is that the bishops in Wales are not nominated by the Prime Minister. And the prayer book used in Wales cannot be interfered with by Parliament, whereas in England it can, and at least theoretically the Prime Minister nominates the bishops of the Church of England in England. You hardly see any difference. The point is that in both England and Wales, public money is spent from parochial schools. Nobody thinks that means that the Church of England or the Catholic Church or any other church is established in Wales. For that matter, in Northern Ireland, the Catholic Church is certainly not established there. Can you imagine those hard-bitten Protestants allowing that? Nevertheless, the state in Northern Ireland pays the whole expense of all the Catholic schools. But nobody thinks that that means that church and state have not been separated and the Catholic Church is established. For that matter, in Southern Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland, the Catholic Church is not an established church. But that doesn't prevent the Constitution of the Republic of Ireland from incorporating some of the Catholic concepts. As a matter of fact, there's an even better example in Southern Ireland that shows that the state can properly do all kinds of things for the support of religion without having an established church. In 1842, if I remember right, the British government suddenly, in a fit of generosity and repentance for the earlier oppression of the Irish people, established Maynooth College for the training of Irish Catholic priests with government money, with taxpayers' money, and maintained it, and indeed paid for it all the way through to 1922 when the Irish Free State was established. But nobody thought that that British government in 1842 believed in establishing the Catholic Church in Ireland. As a matter of fact, if I may digress a moment, it was possibly one of the worst things that Britain actually did for the Irish, because up till then, the would-be Irish priest went to France, Italy, or Spain for his training, as a result of which he came back to Ireland with at least a tincture of culture. But once...
Your time is up, Arthur.
Okay. All right. I finish my sentence. I got a lot more to say, but never mind. Let me just finish that one then. Once he was able to get his training without leaving the old sod, he came out of the seminary the same rustic boor that he was when he went in. Well, I would like to have gone on and talked about the proper limits of the flexibility, where it is right and proper to construe, reconstrue words and so on. They exist. But ultimately, the real test is this. What is the posture? What is the attitude of the judge? Given the right attitude, then he can insert some proper flexibility to move with the times. Given the wrong attitude, he will undermine and destroy the Constitution. And that is this. At all times, his purpose, A, must be to find the law, not to make it. Even though, in the process of finding it, there is a sense in which he makes it. But his purpose is not to make it. Secondly, he must not succumb to the hubris of thinking that he has the right and the power to remake the law. And thirdly, he must see his position as being that of one who has a legacy of the thread of law, going back to wherever it is, hundreds of years in, say, the customary law of England, 200 years in the case of the Constitution, and who sees his duty that however much he improves it, as he thinks he does, he must hand on that thread to the next judge and the next generation, unbroken. Thank you.